Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
We'll be right back.
These were their last words.
The thing that I just started on OutKick that I want you guys to pay attention to, it's related to the same thing.
Speaking of that video that the president just posted about 4 minutes.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said. He said, no, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week. 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right. Okay, well, let's see. Today's, well, we're starting off with, it's open mic. Any kind of things that you guys want to talk about? Safe parking industry, safe parking industries. And I'm in Florida, and practically the whole state's preparing for, it's hurricane season, but they're looking at this as hitting landfall. It's been through Cuba already, headed towards Florida. But hopefully, I'm praying this thing to go out west, but hopefully it won't hit landfall in this neck of the woods. But, anyway, can't control that. But anyway, so I'm sure there are a lot of people looking that are homeless, or even if they have one, they're looking for safe parking. And safe parking, that I see that as an emerging industry. In any event, so anything you guys want to talk about other than that, I'll put it on something like Factory City and, just ride it out. But 619-768-2945. That's the number to call. Let's see. Somebody sent me a text about the woman king. You can talk about that if you guys want to talk. Anything you guys want to talk about. Like, say, I'm sitting down here, sort of like, preparing for a storm. Tropical storm, so I'm here. I'm in Florida, so I'm waiting it out. It hasn't come on shore yet. We've got some rain, and it comes and goes, but it's nothing heavy as of yet. So while I'm here, you guys are elsewhere on the planet. Fill me in on what's happening in your neck of the woods. If you guys want to talk about safe parking or anything, the woman king Soul City, which we talked about that last week. Last week we covered a little bit about Black Townships 2.0. There's a trend out there, as far as I can tell, that black folks are starting to buy land, or they are buying land, not starting to. They are buying land, and they're setting up their own communities away from major population hubs where some of these high-profile homicides have happened. I'm sure somewhere in Minnesota, now George Floyd got killed somewhere like Minneapolis, somewhere like that. That's a major population hub, particularly for up in that neck of the woods. I'm sure you've got some black folk on a household basis or maybe a small little economic, I mean, like in Freedom, Georgia, 19 families, you know. And you got to figure a family's got at least two people. So we're talking about a community of about 38 people. I know bare minimum 38 when you say 19 families. I know of a group that is 12 of them, you know, so, and they bought 110 acres. So, and then another couple, the man and wife, they bought 41 acres, as I mentioned yesterday, up in Montana. So this is a trend, and these I would call safe havens. They're safe parking. That's an emerging industry as far as I'm concerned. But they're safe haven communities. Matter of fact, you know what? Let's see. Safe parking. I'm switching up the title for today. Safe haven. I mean, safe parking and, let me get it right. And safe haven, I'm going to say industries. Okay, here we go. Safe parking and safe haven industries. And the safe haven industries are Freedom, Georgia is one of them. Okay, it's one of them. All right, well, okay. Or it's been kind of quiet for the last 2 days. I know all you jokers can't be living in Florida or near it. Or Georgia, because it's going to pass through Georgia, well, at least part of southern Georgia. All right, well, let's go Steve Harvey. We're just going to pay some, like I said, if you guys want to talk about anything, 619-768-2945, press 1, we'll chop it up.
Listen to me. Rich people think differently. So what I'm going to put in your head today is a rich people concept so you can get to understand it. The only difference between successful people and not is just how they think. Rich people think different. Quit letting people tell you you got to get qualified in another program. You don't need another program to be successful. You need to change the way you think. So here's the deal. The problem with becoming a millionaire is that when you decide that you want to be a millionaire, you immediately start thinking, how can I become a millionaire? Well, that thought don't just pop into your head, so you get frustrated, and you don't become a millionaire. And you start creating stuff like, well, I guess this wasn't the Lord's will, or as soon as I think of how I'm going to make a million. You can't think of how to make $1 million. Stop. Do you know if you knew how to make $1 million, what's the day, Tuesday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? Wouldn't not you make it by Friday? But suppose I told you how you can become a millionaire with what you have. Because here's the deal. All of you have everything it takes to become rich. You just don't believe it. Now, if you can develop this theory that I'm about to share with you, I have the way for you to be rich. This is it. First of all of you have a gift. God gave it to you when he created you. God never created a single soul without giving them a gift. That's the God that created you. He's a very smart God. Here's the cold thing. When he made you, he put the gift inside of you. He didn't hide it under the ocean. It ain't on the mountain nowhere. It ain't under no rocks. You ain't got to go drilling. God put what you needed inside of you at birth. All of you have a gift. But you have got to do your gift, the thing God gave you at birth to do. It is the thing that you do the absolute best with the least amount of effort. That's your gift. Anything else you doing, you wasting your time. Do you hear me? You wasting your time. If when the alarm clock goes off in the morning and it makes you sick every morning that alarm go off, it's because you ain't doing your gift. You're going against what God created you to be. Do most of you know what your gift is? Who in here doesn't know their gift yet? Okay, let me tell you what you do. Go home today. Don't talk to nobody. Sit down and have one conversation with yourself. What is the thing that I do the absolute best with the least amount of effort? This ain't going to take you long. You old enough, you grown. Write it down. I don't care if it's networking. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's doing color. I don't care if it's painting. Whatever it is, it's what you do. Sing it. Whatever you do the best, write it down. That's your gift. That's it. You ain't got to go asking a bunch of people. They've been telling you your whole life. You know, you ever have people call you with their problems? They always call you with your problems because you gifted at it. But you didn't know how to identify it. If you identify your gift. Now, let me ask you this question. This thing that you're gifted at, if you did it for somebody, do you think somebody would pay you $10 for your gift? Just $10. Could you babysit for $10? Could you cut somebody's hair for $10? Could you cut their grass for $10? Could you make them a chicken dinner for $10? Could you do something for $10? Everybody, don't you have something somebody would give you $10 for? Okay, now, once you have something that somebody's willing to pay you $10 for, this is how this works. It's called the multiples of 10. See, you don't have to figure out how to be a millionaire. You just got to figure out the thing that makes you $10. So now here we go. You do it and you make $10. Soon as they pay you the 10, go do it 10 more times. Whatever it was. Watch some more kids. 10 more times. Get another 10. You got $100. When you get $100, whatever you did to make that $100, listen to me, do it 10 more times. You ain't got to get tricky with it. Just do it 10 more times. You'd have made $1,000. Whatever you did to make the $1,000, don't get smart. Stay stupid now. Do it 10 more times. You have now made $10,000. Hold up. Now we finna grow a little bit, but guess what you got to do to grow? You just got to do some more. Whatever you made $10,000 doing, I need you to do it 10 more times. What you tripping for? If you do it 10 more times, you got $100,000. Now, you might have to hire some people to make this happen. You got to figure that part out. But all you got to do is do what you did for $10. Once you make $100,000, uh-oh, if you just do it 10 more times.
All right, okay, it's super quiet around here today. Oh, man, all right, well, let me take this call.
Intellectual property, or IP, a very misunderstood topic. It's not a very exciting topic, but there are four different types of IP, and it's very important to understand the four types of IP. First, the patent. People always talk about patents. You hear people saying, oh, I have this great idea, I'm going to patent that. Oh, this is a great name for this product, I'm going to patent that. It's very misunderstood. Patents are basically the right to exclude other people from making whatever you've created. There are some crazy patents. For example, there's actually a patent for a bird diaper. That would mean that if anyone other than that person decided they were going to make a bird diaper, that person could have stopped them from making the bird diaper. But the way it works is it's an exchange with the government. You're excluding other people from making your bird diaper, but you have to disclose how that bird diaper is made in detail. It's online. It's at the USPTO. You have to disclose that, and then after your patent runs out, which could be anywhere from 14 to 17 years to 20 years, depending on when you got your patent, at that time, the rest of the world can just go right ahead and make bird diapers. So there are two types of patents. There's the utility patent, and then there's design patents. But the whole thing to understand about it is it doesn't give you the right to make whatever you've created. Because, for example, with our bird diaper, there might be something that's used in that that someone else has a patent on. So you might have to go and ask them for the use of their, let's say, Velcro adhesives for the bird diaper. Now, that can get really complicated. And this patents is an area, there's just been a huge change in the law in the U.S., and it's an area that you must consult with a professional, and often that is a patent attorney. Understanding that you're not going to patent a name gives you a little bit more information. What are you going to do with a name, though? A name is something you can trademark, you can copyright. A trademark is something, one of the most famous trademarks would be Coca-Cola, Apple. These are brands. So what you're doing is that trademark for Coca-Cola on the bottle tells you that if I pour the contents of that bottle into my glass, I, as a consumer, am protected. I'm not going to get Pepsi. I am going to get Coca-Cola. That's the deal that is made. So the exchange is Coca-Cola pays for that trademark. They have the right to use it, and as long as they renew it, they get to keep using it. Now, Coca-Cola is a really great example of a trade secret. So a trade secret is often used instead of a patent. So if you think about the recipe for Coca-Cola, that has been around for over 100 years. If they would have patented the recipe and the process for making Coca-Cola way back when, it would have long since been an expired patent, and then everyone in the world would know how to make Coca-Cola. So what they do instead is they keep it as a trade secret. You don't necessarily have to go to an attorney to protect a trade secret because there isn't any way of filing like there is for a patent, a trademark, or a copyright. So with trade secrets, you do have to consult with a professional to make sure that however you're protecting it is proper and will meet whatever state law it applies to you. Now, with Coke, they do something really cool with it. They actually have divided up the secrets, so there's very few people who know the entire process. There's restaurants where there's secret recipes, and you'll actually have different kitchens where part of the process is done in one kitchen, part of the process is done in a different kitchen. There's many people who say, well, hey, I don't have any trade secrets, but things like customer lists, supplier relationships, these are trade secrets. Know-how about how you put together your software, trade secret. So with trade secrets, they're basically free to protect, but the very important thing about them is once the cat's out of the bag, that's it. No more trade secrets. So it's a pro and con between trying to patent something and keeping it as a trade secret. A final piece of IP is copyrights. Copyright does not mean the right to copy. So what it means is that once I write something down, once this video is recorded, someone has copyright in this video. And then that doesn't mean that nobody can copy it. What it means is that you have to figure out what are the permissions of use. For example, there's a great site, Creative Commons, where people put things on there, photographs and videos, and people can come and use them once you read the permissions. So the copyright is with the author. It lasts for the life of the author plus a number of years that keeps increasing. So as an author, you don't really have much to worry about during your lifetime, but then it becomes really interesting after someone dies. And a really good example of that is with Walt Disney, because the things that Walt Disney has created are all copywritten, but Walt Disney has passed away many years ago. So a lot of people refer to copyright as kind of the Disney law because the years after the author's death keeps getting bigger and bigger. So those are the four types of IP. You have your patents, your trademarks, and your copyrights, and your trade secrets. And for those of you who are still watching, thank you. And you might want to ask yourself, why? Why do I care about this? Because actually almost half the value of most companies in the U.S. and the EU is intangible assets. And those intangible assets are intellectual property. It's the patents, the trademarks, the copyrights, and the trade secrets. So make sure that you understand what those things are so you can make sure that you protect them.
Understanding the psychology of the self can mean the difference between success and failure, love and hate, bitterness and happiness. The discovery of the real self can rescue a crumbling marriage, recreate a faltering career, and transform victims of personality failure. On another plane, discovering your real self means the difference between freedom and the compulsions of conformity. Welcome to the in-depth book summary of the self-development classic Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz. The statement just made is quite a significant claim with big implications, but if you understand the depth of the concept presented here, it's true. It can drastically change your life. The book is called Psycho-Cybernetics because people have a mind that operates as a goal-striving machine, also known as a cybernetic system. This cybernetic system is impersonal and will accept any goal that the mind holds in front of it. The mind can be used to feed our bodies either wanted or unwanted beliefs and images. The cybernetic system will act on these. It does not matter if they are positive or negative. So the way we change the behaviors of our body is first changing the contents of our minds. Having a picture in your mind of living in hell makes your body feel like it's living in hell and in turn be angry and anxious. Having a picture in your mind of living in heaven makes your body feel like it's living in heaven and in turn making you act freely and confident. This by learning, practicing and experiencing new habits of thinking, imagining, remembering and acting, we can change the way we behave. A great example of a cybernetic system is a heat-seeking missile. It consists of a propulsion mechanism and a sensor that makes a feedback loop to check if the current course is correct. If the course is not correct, the propulsion mechanism will adjust its course and continue. If we relate this back to ourselves, we also have a propulsion mechanism which is our body, and we have a lot of sensors which we interpret data that is used to operate the body. This data contains not only our senses, but also our self-image, different beliefs, and mental pictures. If any of these do not represent reality correctly, our body will show unwanted behavior. Self-image plays a huge role in the steering of our own bodies, because the self-image is like a blueprint of how we should behave, what we are capable of doing, how much money we're able to make, if we're confident or not. All these things are contained in our self-image. So changing the self-image can have great effect on your behaviors. Don't underestimate the power that the beliefs you hold about yourself have. The book gives several examples of hypnotized people that can do simple tasks just because a hypnotist gave them a belief they can't do it. You see people struggling to pull their hand up from a table or try and remember their name and they simply can't do it. That is how powerful beliefs are. The way we change the beliefs in our self-image is by rationally falsifying current beliefs and then creating new ones that do fit into our new self-image. We do this by utilizing the main rule of our self-image, that all the beliefs contained in a self-image must seem consistent with each other. The belief must seem consistent, but a lot of the times they are not. Shining a light on this will falsify a belief which then can be changed into a new positive one. A great example from the book. There was a salesman who was scared to death when calling on big shots. His fear and nervousness were overcome by asking him, "Would you physically get down on all fours and crawl into the man's office, prostrating yourself before a superior personage?" "I should say not," the man said. "Then why do you mentally cringe and crawl?" Another question. "Would you go into a man's office with your hand out like a beggar and beg for a dime for a cup of coffee?" "Certainly not," the man said. "Can't you see you're doing essentially the same thing when you go in overly concerned with whether or not he will approve of you? Can't you see you have your hand literally begging for his approval and acceptance of you as a person?" Here Maxwell shined light on the fact that this man had a belief that he was a worthy individual capable of doing great work. while on the other hand, he behaved very differently towards his superiors. By shining light on this fact, the behavior towards his superiors changed. Two great beliefs that almost all people hold that can be used to falsify beliefs are: 1. The fact that you are capable of doing your share of the work, exerting independence, and 2. The belief that there is something inside of you which should not be allowed to suffer indignities. Another way to change the self-image is by rationally convincing yourself a belief is false and that another one is appropriate. By looking at your unwanted behaviors, you can discover unwanted beliefs, and these can be disproven and swapped for a better belief. Once you discover an unwanted belief, ask yourself these questions. What belief supports this action? Why do I believe this? Is this belief based on actual fact or assumption or false conclusion? Is there any rational reason for such a belief? Could it be that I am mistaken in this belief? Would I come to the same conclusion about some other person in a similar situation? Why should I continue to act and feel as if this were true if there are no good reason to believe it? Go deep into these questions. Try and attack the unwanted belief from all possible angles. The reason why this method works is that the beliefs we hold are not fixed to reality. We interpret reality in a certain way, and that is how we form beliefs. When asking yourself all these questions, you're looking for a different interpretation of reality that makes more sense. A lot of bad events can be recontextualized this way and seen in as a learning experience where you can take away a key thing you learned in that moment. A great example from my own life. I used to always think that people are essentially evil because they always try to grab as much power as possible, they try to get as much money as possible. They hoard survival needs just for the sake of hoarding it so they can sit on top of this hierarchy and feel good about themselves. Now, this poses a real problem because you start to see these same evil behaviors in yourself. This isn't really good for your happiness and self-image. You also start to show underlying hostility towards strangers because you assume they are evil too. Now, after I did some thinking, I came to the conclusion that these behaviors that are labeled evil are just survival mechanisms. They're very irrational at this point because you have enough to survive, but that just shows you how unsafe these people feel. They are just trying to get by and are a slave to their drives to be the best and have the most, which isn't really the best way to live. In this way, I see them more as victims trying to fight insecurities instead of these evil people that are out to get you. Apart from self-image as a sensor to steer our body, imagination also plays a huge role. The things we imagine in our heads determine our actions. Throughout the day, we are constantly imagining things in our minds. This affects our behavior and mental state. The key here is to become conscious of what you are imagining on a day-to-day basis and improving upon it. For example, constantly feeding yourself mental pictures of people gossiping about you, and you will become hostile or shy because your body gets defensive. Things don't really need to be real or physical. The mind cannot distinguish from mental imagery or direct physical experience and will react the same way when you just imagine that everybody is gossiping about you or when they actually are. So always stay alert on what you play in your mind. Notice that when you're assuming everybody is gossiping about you, it's just in your head, and there's most likely almost no real basis for it. Instead, picture how you want things to be. Picture yourself at a new job or acting very outgoing and accepting towards other people. These mental pictures will build new memories for you. As I told you before, your mind can tell the difference between real and false pictures. So the things you imagine on a daily basis will be stored just the same as real memories, and you use memories as a basis to determine your actions. So a lot of imagined confidence will leak into your everyday actions. Now keep in mind that beliefs also play a huge role. Only imagination will most likely not help that much, but combine the two and there will be a lot of progress. Now the book also advises to set aside time in your day to imagining what you want your life to become, or how you want to behave in certain situations. This is great because when you really focus on imagining, you can paint more vivid pictures in your mind that arouse more vivid emotions. This will represent reality better and thus will have a bigger impact because it is stored better. Just imagining a vague picture of you going to the grocery store and buying healthy products won't have a really big impact. But imagining eating healthy with all the detail you can, arousing the emotions in yourself that you feel when you're eating this healthy meal, the different flavors, the different colors of your meal, the metal fork in your hand, picturing the details as vivid as possible. This will create a strong memory and will help you a lot more than a vague picture. While doing a whole lot of other good things to your body, relaxation is also a key aspect of changing your behavior, because making an effort to change something actually reinforces it. You're actually feeding your negative habits by focusing on them and trying to change them by conscious thought. You're creating a bigger basis for them to exist on. You need to be able to relax and trust that in time you will change as long as you hold the intended goal or behavior in mind. What you're doing when you worry is reintroducing the idea of the thing that is wrong in your mind again and again in order to try and change it. But guess what? Your imagination will be fixed on that bad picture and you will move towards that. Instead, introduce the bad behavior once, recognize it, rationally reframe it, determine a new wanted behavior instead of the one you're doing right now, and then keep that wanted response in your mind, together with a desire for the attainment of this response. The actual action that is being done does not matter. Either positive or negative practice will both be beneficial as long as you stay relaxed and keep the new wanted behavior in mind. Another reason why relaxation is so great is the relief of stress and anxiety. Response means tension. Anger, hostility, fear, anxiety, insecurity are all responses and thus form tension. How do we battle tension? By relaxation. It has been proven that you absolutely cannot feel angry, fearful, anxious, insecure or unsafe as long as your muscles remain perfectly relaxed. Tension in your muscles is a preparation for action. Relaxation of your muscles brings mental relaxation too, and thus creates a distance from the outside world where it has less effect on your mindset. If you are relaxed, you're disengaged from the outside world. It has no effect on your mental state. The book has several great exercises that help a lot with relaxation. There are a lot of different...
Okay, we put in a little filler in there. We retitled today's podcast, but it's open mic. Anything you guys want to talk about. Safe Parking and Safe Haven Industries. There are, I became aware of about a year ago. Yeah, if that, probably less. There are people that have RVs, cars, et cetera. They're looking for, you know, they're looking for safe places to park their car or RV. Because they live in their car or RV. But over the weekend, what, Sunday, I believe it was, somebody was telling me on Clubhouse, you keep on hearing me talking about Clubhouse, which is an app. Download the Clubhouse app to your phone. And she was telling me about, did she ask me, did I know about the, you know, where the in-state tuition at UCLA is something like, well, you know what, since I got the phone here, I mean, internet, tuition, I'm going to read it up verbatim, tuition at UCLA, California, Los Angeles. Okay. Wait a minute, am I reading this right? Okay. UCLA tuition costs, undergraduate. Okay. Tuition costs at UCLA, that's the tuition. For in-state students, California residents, is $13,225. Room and board is an additional $15,816. Books and supplies, $1,509. Transportation, $432. Personal stuff, $1,470. Health insurance, $2,225. So total cost for a resident student at UCLA is $34,667, but we're just going to take the tuition. The tuition, well, you know what? We're going to take the tuition. That's $13,225 for in-state students, and a room and board, the roof over your head, $15,860. That's at UCLA. All right. Now, let's see. UCLA out of state. Let's see. Right, out of state. They got it at $17,000, about four more thousand more than in-state. $17,000 room and board, $17,231. Oh, this. No, wait a minute. Let me. All right, how much tuition for out of state? Okay. All right, here we go. In-state at UCLA. This is in-state tuition, California residents. $13,249. Out of state tuition is $43,003. That's the UCLA. So now on top of all that is she told me that UCLA has a parking lot. They have a parking lot and they have a Facebook page for students that are homeless that can't afford to live in a dorm or share a house with other people, or they're living out of their cars, their vans, their trucks, their school, whatever they got. It's called, they have a parking lot set up for that. It's called a safe parking program. If you, matter of fact, if you go to Facebook with me right now and put in UCLA safe parking. And let's get to their Facebook page. Okay. It's, Eric, the Facebook page, here's the exact keywords. Safe Parking UCLA. That's on Facebook. Safe Parking UCLA. Make sure you like it. And read up at the top. Okay. Who is Safe Parking UCLA? We are a coalition of student leaders, campus organizations, and community partners advocating for the creation of safe parking program at UCLA. Okay. What is safe parking? This is across the country, people. This is just not at UCLA. I was shocked because I never, UCLA? All right. So what is safe parking? Safe parking refers to the parking facilities that are free of charge, safe, hygienic, and reliable for individuals living out of their cars. This is at the University of California, Los Angeles, the UCLA Bruins. This is not some community college, all right? Why does UCLA need a safe parking program? UCLA students are suffering from exorbitant housing costs in Westwood, that's the section of Los Angeles, the single most expensive neighborhood for renters in the entire state of California. This is a huge problem, especially when students come from different socioeconomic backgrounds. There are other colleges that have safe parking. There are other cities in the United States that have municipal safe parking programs. The reason why I gotta find my studio. It's an industry. It's an emerging industry. Oh, wait a minute. I'm trying to get back to Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. Hold on, getting back to my studio, folks. I'm maneuvering this on my phone. Okay. So, I retitled, and the reason why I'm saying, all right, I retitled Safe Parking and Safe Haven Industries, because this is a wide open opportunity. Pleasant Stephens said this some years ago, and Pleasant Stephens is still with us. Keep him in the prayer. So we had some good days and some not so good days, but he's at home and he's eating. He's doing a lot of sleeping recently and whatnot, but he's still with us, so he's not bedridden or nothing like that. He gets out of the house and, you know, he's got his appetite and all that most days. But anyway, that's the latest on him. I'll bring Delmar on here one day to update you on that. But anyway, but safe parking lots, that's an emerging market for entrepreneurism, in my opinion. And also, I updated today's title to Safe Haven. So Safe Parking and Safe Haven Industries. So if you've got a carport, a parking space, a garage that you're not using, a piece of land that's got some space on it, there are people out here that are willing to pay you to park in those places. Do your research. It's an emerging market. Some places like, I know Seattle, Washington, and King County, which is in Washington State. If you're not set up properly there, code enforcement will shut you down. Okay. However, there are over 3,000 counties in the United States. There are over 41,000 zip codes in the United States. And if you go back to our Facebook page, It's My House TV, and you scroll down, I put this on here last week, but it's still up there near the top. Look for two maps titled Pockets of Freedom. And those pink areas, and that's an old map. But Pockets of Freedom, where there's very low government regulation when it comes to housing, in a lot of those places, and that's why they call it Pockets of Freedom, you can find plenty of places where you can legally park. Or you can, you know, some of these parking safe havens and some of these schools and municipalities that have safe parking programs, you know, some of them have, typically if you're going to be sleeping in your car or something like that, you know, there's no bathroom or nothing like that. But at somebody, that's why I'm calling this an industry. At some of these places, you know, they have hygiene centers, I'll call it that. And within the hygiene center, you know, you got a bathroom. Some of them have showers, you know. And in some of them, you know, they have, if you need food, you know, they have a place right there within the parking lot where they serve food during it, you know, all through the night. You know, so it's an emerging market. And if you look at it, the federal interstate highway system has been doing this for years anyway. I mean, I slept plenty of times, you know, on a Highway 95, you know, which has Highway 95 typically has nice rest areas that many of them are open all night long, and you can go in there and use typically on, you know, the interstate, you know, I-75, I-95, I-10, whatever. Typically, their bathrooms are clean, and, you know, in some areas they have truck stops, you know, where you can take a shower. You know, they have, you know, Roy Rogers, or you want fresh food, whatever food they have at those interstate. So, you know, now this is, but a lot of people, and a lot of truckers sleep there, and a lot of travelers just to, you know, let me rest, let me catch a couple of, and, you know, the state troopers that come through, they leave you alone. Okay. But now, this is a serious housing crisis. Like UCLA, man, hey. You know, they got the $13,000 in tuition. The out-of-state kids, people, because you got all people of all ages at the university, they've got the $43,000 tuition. But, man, a lot of them can't. Think about it. Because, really, you might just need a room. The typical college student just needs a room, man. But a lot of them can't afford a room. Now, they have a working car. They got the tuition money. But, man, it's just, they can't find enough partners to partner up with to rent a house. But it's not just now, because L.A. is an expensive area. Los Angeles, California. But we're talking about pick your state. You know, you might catch a break in Ohio, or what do you call it, somewhere in West Virginia. And mind you, I said might. Because in Cleveland and in Toledo, you got some struggling people. You got some struggling folk. And that's everybody. You know, a lot of people say, that's why I don't buy into this idea of white supremacy. Man, you go to West Virginia or Ohio or Michigan, place like Flint, Michigan, you will find some dirt for white folks. They don't have no trust. That's where I don't get the supremacy part. Seen some poor white folks. Struggling folks. Anyway, but safe parking, safe haven industries, I'm looking at that as an emerging market here in the United States. You might want to look into it. Okay, now. That's my rant on safe parking and safe haven industries, what I have deemed as an emerging market. So if you want to talk about The Woman King, which is a controversial film among black folks. Some people have drawn a line in the sand on that one. So if you want to talk about that, I think some people are upset about, because if you go back with the history of it, they were slaves. Somebody out there, correct me if I'm wrong. And once again, the Pianki brought this up a couple of weeks ago, last week. The Woman King. It is not a scene-by-scene actual account of what happened. The film is based on, you know, things that have happened. But you can go online and read about the film, because some people are upset that it had a white director and all this other stuff. But Viola Davis, I'm sure she read the script, and, you know, she said, well, their interviews, I'll let her speak for herself. And then it is talk of other African actresses that turned the role down. Yeah, well, that's what actors do, man. You know? So, and we don't know if that other person had another film commitment or whatever. So, but if you want to talk about The Woman King, like I say, I'm in Florida, so I'm praying that the storm will shift gears and head west. But right now, it's overcast where I'm at and quiet. Not even raining. It rained a teeny bit last night, but right now it's overcast. And people are driving their cars as they do and taking their walks as they regularly do or jogging as they regularly do. And then I'm going to go make me some vittles after I get through with this podcast. But in any event, okay, let me stop running my mouth. Let's go to the phone lines here. Once again, 619-768-2945. 314, your mic is open.
15 minutes normal, earlier than normal. That's pretty good, LA. 16 minutes.
Well, I'm getting better.
Yeah, you're getting better. And, you know, as you get better, you would notice that you're keeping more of your money because you can cut things shorter and not have to pay as much, which is a good thing to keep money in your
pocket. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So now, are you in Louisiana today or Missouri?
I'm down south today.
Okay.
And
well,
storm is at Cuba right now.
Yeah, I heard it beat up on Cuba pretty bad. Yeah.
Yeah, but they know how to handle it because they're used to it.
That's true. They are used to it.
Yes. And, you know, you talk about the how students arrange themselves when they go off to college. It's like out the U.S., UCLA, and so on. And that there shows you some dedication and steadfastness to do what it takes. And that's a good thing.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah.
You can find out about this what actually yesterday?
No, I'm still working on it. Oh, wait a minute. Go ahead, Pianki. I had to say somebody's at the door. Go ahead. I'm listening.
Yeah, it sounds like a federal server or somebody. I don't know.
No. No, that's a guy I meant to.
But, no, that's a good thing. They know how to carry that out. And yes, those housing at LSU is like $24,000 a year. My grandson stayed in Kirby Smith his first year. Then second year, I bought him a home. They require you to stay in on campus the first year.
On campus the first day, that's a requirement? Yes, okay.
Huh. I guess it's a way they got some very elegant residencies here for students at UCLA. Matter of fact, the building he stayed in, they tore it down. It was like a 7-story, 8-story building, and they built a new one. They've been building new residencies on campus and even across the way from campus there across the Highland Avenue. And
okay.
It can be people, young people are, you can go in, my grandson said there's advertisement on community boards for roommates and so on, so on, so on. So it's always some place to stay. But $24,000 a year for residency, then about another $4,000 for meal tickets, then about, I guess if you're carrying a full load, they can get up about 30-something. So
yeah, college education is not cheap.
Yeah, especially if you go into those schools that offer the more advanced degrees, like in engineering, medical. Now,
right.
Liberal arts schools, things are a lot cheaper.
Well, the thing is, the way things are, you really can't, you really sort of have to stay away from a lot of that liberal arts stuff.
Well, you're absolutely right. I don't know how people get into $100,000 debt in a liberal arts program. But if you carry in the hard courses, the 5 credit hours per course, like down here you got your math courses, your advanced math and your science, they carry about 5 credit hours. And it takes a lot of studying in order to master them. And they got husbandry courses where you work with animals, horses, and cows, veterinarian.
Right.
I think the nursing programs, they got a nursing program. They just, when he first came down here, they was adding on and completing $100 million in improvements to their engineering facilities. They got live oil wells, live gas wells for those who's pursuing that line of reasoning.
Right.
You know, so if the university is kind of centered around energy, then they've got a community, sort of like a community college that's connected to LSU that offer things like printing, more of your architecture and design. At the elementary school and middle school, they have aviation charter schools, Helix.
That's impressive, aviation charter school.
So it's a pretty good atmosphere. It's wonderful. Then you got your nuts. You got an area down here where your nuts are. Some of your cousins, there's a white woman waiting at a train passing, and some fool walked up and killed her.
Oh.
There at Ivana Presley's rally in Massachusetts, they jumped on a black conservative. Savagely attacked him.
Okay.
You know, it's really bad when people want to resort to that type of behavior because you are opposite them in your philosophy and ideology. As if they want to have carte blanche over you and your way of life and surely your way of thinking.
Right.
And up there in Maine, you had some more of your cousin. Going to take us back to the stagecoach era and the great train robbery area. They robbed the whole damn train. Light rail. And I'm not sure if they didn't get away on horseback. Everything's going on. But, you know, in St. Louis, we had some kids that were sleeping in the airport and carrying a very, you know, very decent GPA, 4.0, but they were sleeping in the airport. So.
Oh, I know. My travel agent told me there are people at an airport that not too far from me. There are people, and I can believe it because the airport is clean. Because I when I catch a flight out there, I typically go like probably about a good 8 hours ahead of time before the flight. because I don't want to get caught up in the wrong.
You're waiting on a flight. You look like you're waiting on a flight too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm waiting on a flight. Like if like when I had to go to Chicago, the flight was leaving out, 6:30 in the morning. So I don't want to I don't want to be leaving out of my house at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. because the traffic on I-4 going to the airport is horrendous, and I don't like to be rushing. So I'll get to the airport like at 10 or 11, no later than midnight, and they got plenty of places with Wi-Fi and comfortable places, and right there at the, I'll tell you, the airport is Orlando. And when I was talking to her, she told me, she said she knows some people living at that airport, and I can believe it. I can believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know there's anything like that, but
Yeah, anyway, that's what I want to contribute. I'm not going to hold the show. I'm getting ready to get off. And
okay, well, it's kind of quiet. Like I say, here it's what they call the quiet before the storm. So
somebody's asking me to come and get involved in a discussion. So I'm going to head up to Virginia and see what they're talking about. But anyway, nice.
No, what part of Virginia?
I think it's Raleigh.
Okay, good talking to you, too.
All right, then.
Okay, talk to you soon. Bye. All right, well, you guys want to chop it up about anything? 619-768-2945. Let's see. If not, Woman King, you can talk anything you guys want to talk about. If not, I'm looking at my music here. Let me see. All right. Let's see. Okay, well, we got a quiet day here today. Let's see. Okay, well, we got some time here. All right, well, let's play this, Umar.
Well, the one thing that I wanted to highlight, because I think it's very, very critical to look at, and that is the disparity in wealth ownership between so-called African Americans and white people. The disparity in wealth ownership. We have to understand something, and Neely Fuller does an excellent job of discussing this, even though he's not a psychologist by training, from my understanding, but he does a good job of talking about psycholinguistics and how the words that are used shape your interpretation of your reality. The white man is master in coming up with words and then using those words to impact the way black people perceive our reality. For example, one such concept is middle class, the black middle class. There is no such thing as a black middle class. Class is a Marxist concept, a Leninist Marxist concept that relates to ownership of the means of production. In order to be middle class, you must have access to and control over corporations and institutions. Class is about wealth. What do you own in terms of resources, land, businesses, stocks, material wealth? That's what class is about. Black people don't own a damn thing. We don't have class. We simply have black people who make a little bit more money than other black people. But that does not put them in a different class. When you look at poor white people and you look at the white middle class, What makes the white middle class separate from poor whites? It's because they own things, and they are able to live off of residual income. The average white middle class person has investments that allow them to get paid even while they're not working. That's what makes them middle class. They own wealth. If you look at the average white person's assets, in fact, the current census that was done said the average wealth of a black middle class home, middle class, is about $5,000. No wealth, but cash in the bank. $5,000. The average wealth of a white middle class home is more than $100,000. You're looking at a $95,000 just minimally. Incredibly worse than that.
Brother Umar.
Yes, sir.
I just wanna be clear about what you just said. Did they say that $5,000 a week?
No. $5,000 in total assets for that home.
$5,000?
In other words,
like,
if you add up, yes, if you add up what the family is worth, add up their net worth, that's land, property, investment, stocks, add it up, and the average black home is at $5,000 U.S.
Damn. And that
that's almost enough.
Middle class?
And that can qualify. Well, the $5,000 doesn't qualify you for middle class, but that's how much wealth the average black middle class person
has. Average black. Okay, okay. All right. I'm clear now. Okay.
So in other words, the average black middle class person is making more money. Excuse me. They're making more money than the poor black, but they don't have more saved up than the poor black. Because as you know, the more we make, the more we spend. So, for example, if I'm a working-class black, I might have a $20,000 car note. But the minute I get an $80,000 job, I want me a Benz. So I went from a $20,000 car to a $80,000 or $90,000 car. Only make $80,000. But because I'm middle class, I feel like I have to look the part. So we end up spending even more money on excess materialism. So when you look at how much money the poor black person has saved and how much money the middle class person has saved, it's about the same amount of money. In fact, there was a study that said that the average black middle class, we ain't talking poor, we talking so-called middle class blacks, is two paychecks away from poverty. The average middle class black family, because of their house and their car and all the expensive stuff that they have, all the credit cards, if they got fired, they could survive a month. On the flip side, the average middle-class white family, because that's true class, they have wealth. The average middle-class white family could live at least a year if they were laid off of work. At least a year before they would have to start being concerned about how they're going to keep a roof over their head. 12 months. Black person, 1 month. There's no such thing as a black middle class. And let me say this. Look at how they define class. In America, class is defined only by two things. How much money you make isn't one. I want to be clear about this. I want to make sure the listeners are clear. How much money you make has nothing to do with your class category. I want to be clear about that. The only two things they look at is how much education you have and your occupation. Where do you work? Let me repeat this. How much education you have and where do you work? So let me give you an example. You have a doctorate degree in education. A doctorate degree in education. But in your school district where you work at, all the white people control all the upper echelon jobs, the middle management jobs, the principal jobs, the administrative jobs. They're all controlled by white folks and a couple of token Negroes. So the fact that you have a doctorate degree did not earn you more money, because there's no positions in your school district to which you can graduate to. So you have a doctorate. You're still a school teacher. You're raising three or four children, possibly by yourself, which is a situation many of our sisters are in who are educators. So you're raising two or three children by yourself. You're a school teacher. You have a doctorate degree. Because you have a doctorate and because you're a school teacher, you're going to be considered probably upper class with your doctorate. Your doctorate degree makes you upper class, or at least upper middle class. On paper. But in reality, the situation is what? Because you're only making about $40,000 in your job, and that's gross, not net. Your take-home pay is less than $20,000 a year, and you're raising three or four kids, despite having a doctorate, despite being a teacher, your take-home pay is equivalent or less than a black person who's considered to be poor. An impoverished black person has the same take-home pay as many so-called upper-middle-class black people. It is the illusion of progress. The same amount of money they have to spend is no different than a poor black person. They're identical in terms of actual net pay that comes home. But because they have a doctorate and because they're a school teacher or a physician or an engineer or a counselor or a school nurse, okay, they're automatically considered middle class when the truth of the matter is they're just as broke as the people in the ghetto.
Lord have mercy. Collect your Gucci bag is going down. That's interesting. My eyes are wide open right now.
Now, okay. We saw the spending report for black people, and I think this was the 2011 spending report. 2012's might not be out yet. For 2011, they said black people spend more time on the internet, more money on the cell phone, more money on cell phone minutes, more money on internet minutes. So we are clearly dominating in the, what do we call that, World Wide Web markets. Now,
yes.
The interesting thing that the report pointed out is black people are different in one major way than every other consumer in America. Two ways. The first way is we are conspicuous in our consumption. We buy stuff not because we need it, but because it is available. This was one of the biggest findings of the study. Black people will buy it just because it's new. In other words, you have an iPhone 4. Nothing's wrong with your iPhone 4. But a commercial just came out that there's an iPhone 5. So you're going to go out and spend $400 on an iPhone 5. That's only slightly different than the iPhone 4. And why are you buying it? Because you need it? No. You're buying it because it is available. The study said black people are unlike everyone else. Most Americans buy things when they need it. They said black people buy it just because it's available. This is what white folks are saying. Put it out there and the niggas are going to buy it. Because, and then they said that black people, more than any other people, what they own seems to reflect their own estimation of their self-worth. Look at that. What they buy. For most people, what they buy does not reflect their self-worth. But for black people, what they buy reflects their self-worth. That's taking us back to post-traumatic slavery disorder. That's taking us back to low racial self-esteem. It's saying the reason why we got a million pocketbooks, a million cars, a million pairs of sneakers, shoes, clothes, jeans, whatever we into, the reason why we have it is because on a subconscious level, we feel worthless. And so we buy all the material garbage as a vicarious way of adding value to ourselves. In other words, look at what I'm driving. Look at what I'm wearing. We use that to add worth to us. You see it in the schools with our children. Our children do never debate over what they know. They never debate over who they are. They only debate over what they own. Public school is nothing but a what? Fashion show where black children go and compete with other black children for how much they are worth based on what they are wearing and based on what they own. This is what we have created. A whole generation of baby niggers who don't know how to do anything but buy what white people make and then use it to look better than the next black person. Think about it. Whenever black people... Whenever we are congregated, what do we do when we're congregated? In the average black event, they stare each other up and down. The fellas look at each other to see how well they dress. The ladies look at each other to see how well they dress. And this is grown black people. The children have it even worse.
Okay, I guess that ran out. All right, well, we start. This is open mic today. I'm in Florida. It's real quiet where I'm at right now. Overcast, real quiet. And normal things of, you know, people taking their daily walk, you know, jogging, walking, taking the dog out. Mailman's come by already at their usual time. And anyway, we started out with talking about what I consider two emerging markets, or at least if you can look at it as one, parking. We all know about parking, but safe parking. Yeah, all right, let's make it one industry. But two things under the safe parking industry. We got safe parking lots, like they're doing out at UCLA, other colleges, and some municipalities. They have safe parking lots. Walmart's been doing it for some time. You know, you can camp out at Walmart overnight, and by 7 o'clock in the morning, you got to clear up. You know, but that's not at all Walmart. So that's at some of them. So safe parking lot. That I consider that an emerging market. And you'll probably have some people that will become millionaires from that. I'm pretty sure of that. And then the other one, what I would be called, which I consider an emerging industry, safe havens. Now, safe havens are places where you can park your, not, it's more than parking your car. But like I talked about yesterday we talked about Black Townships 2.0. Now, what has come across my radar is Freedom, Georgia, which is 19 black families got together. And you got to, let's just streamline this. 19 families, to make a family, you got to have at least two people. So 19 times two, so that's at least 38 people. You know it's more than that. But at least 32 people that came together and initially bought 97 acres of land, now they're up to a 502. Are they outliers? Well, let's take inventory. I know of enough, matter of fact, some regular lists. I want them to come on and give their story one day. But there's some people that are listening to It's My House on a regular. I've met one of them, a group of 12. They live in the northern state for the most part. They bought 110 acres of land in Georgia. What's going on in Georgia? Okay. All right. Then, in the past, we've had, you know, an African couple that they bought some land and they started their own farm out in Arizona. And then there's another black woman, once again, these are all black folks, from Baltimore, bought 10 acres of land out in Arizona. I'm working on getting all those people back on so we can hear them all day by day. Now, these are new people. Then, over the weekend, I talked about this yesterday, a black couple that was living in West Palm Beach, Florida, that's like about three hours away from where I'm at right now. They bought 41 acres of land in Montana. Now, that's just what I know about. Oh, and, of course, you know, they got a couple of listeners on here that I know about. I don't know everybody's business. Yeah, they've got acres of land. Yeah, I got a little bit myself as well. So what I'm saying is I'm looking at this. There's a lot more out there that I don't know about. I know I was in on some calls, a group out of Illinois, out of the Chicagoland area. I don't know if they found any land yet, but they've been looking. Pleasant Stephens, before he got ill this year, he was out looking for land in Illinois. So now this is just what I know in my little tiny microscopic part of the universe. I'm looking at, because I consider myself like an amateur, what do you call it, futurist. You won't have, but you might not have droves like you did with the Black Exodus, the Black, you know, the Exodus 1 and 2. But you do. Now, you got some white folks, too. They're doing the eco-village thing. There are new towns or villages popping up all around the globe. Today's village will be somebody's city tomorrow. But what I like is you got black folk right here in the United States that, they, you know what, they're not waiting on their 40 acres to be issued out by the government. Just like that couple out of West Palm Beach, Florida, they bought 41 acres in Montana. Now, some people, because I was having a little back and forth in, you know, a chat this morning with, well, it really wasn't a chat. We were messaging each other. And I suggested that she, because she's in a DMV right now, but she's moving to Nevada, Las Vegas to be specific. And I was telling her, you know, and I sent her, you know, the article about the black couple with the 41 acres in Montana. And I said, you might want to consider, since you're going back out west anyway, is, and she's going to a state that's got, if you know how to look in the right place, they have inexpensive land too. But I see you might want to consider Santa Ana, North Carolina. You might want to consider Montana and the Dakotas. Because I talked to a guy earlier this year. I got to track him down. He moved from the south to someplace like Bismarck, North Dakota. I'm just saying. These are what I call barometers. And particularly the black woman, if you, and I mean this in a positive light, black women, black American women, you need to follow some of these black women that are buying acres of land in places where there's not a whole lot of black folk. And also not a whole lot of police or law enforcement. Let's count it down again. A black couple that were living in West Palm Beach, Florida, they bought, and I got it on It's My House. Go on our Facebook page, It's My House TV on Facebook. Scroll down. I got it up, the video. And subscribe to their channel on YouTube. A black couple moves from Florida to Montana. Okay? And they'll tell you the reasons why they're making a move. Or why they made the move and bought the 41 acres. They did their research for 3 years. But let me tell you, here's the barometer part. That husband of hers wasn't going to move nowhere until his wife, who's a black woman, said, this is going to be our new home. I've had Crystal Vanner on here. She's a black woman that lives in a van. She moved to South Dakota. Black woman. Barometer number two. A few years ago, we got in the archives. An African man and his wife, but they're both Africans. They bought some land out in Arizona, God knows, 10 acres, 20 acres. They could have. We're going to get them back on here so you can talk to them personally. If the wife wasn't going to move, black woman, barometer number three. That's just within It's My House and our little community here. 110 acres that was bought by 12 people. I don't know the ratio to men and women,
but there are women in the group. And in Freedom, Georgia, the idea started with two black women. You get 10, they said, go to Freedom, Georgia on YouTube. Subscribe to their channel. Like every, they only got 5 videos unless they let them sit overnight. Get the first one, 58. It's 58 seconds long. She just runs it down real simple. Her and her ride-or-die partner. So you know what? If we get some people together, we can buy this. Cooperative economics. You talk to 10 people, I talk to 10 people. That's where the 19 families came out of. You know, I might have to do a video called 19 Family Members. You already know about 9 friends. And they, from an idea to social capital to coming up with the money out of 19 families to the 96.71 acres to now it's up to 502 acres. Look at the videos and count the black women. There are black men in there, too. I'm just saying, the men ain't going no place unless the woman says, it's a wrap, let's do it. It's a trend. And I'm sure there are other people, other black units of people that are saying, you know what, let's go forward, let's concentrate on that, let's get our reparations this way. Let's get our 40 acres this way. They're tired of struggling. They're tired of eating fake food. To live in the city, man, it, no matter what color or race you are, you got to have some money. Any event, that's my take on that. So safe havens and safe parking, I look at those two industries that are emerging. If you guys want to talk about that or the Woman King, because you got black, that film has polarized various black folk. It has polarized various black folk. So we want to chop it up about that, 619-768-2945. And I have not seen the movie yet. I plan on seeing it. I'm an Amazon guy myself, so if it's on Amazon, I don't know if it's on Amazon now, it could be. But I will watch it. But from what I've heard, some people don't like, you know, the depiction of black folks enslaving other, well, see, they didn't look at it as black folks versus black folks. Back during their time, there was no color as we know it today. It was tribe versus tribe, you know, different tribes, different cultures, different languages, although the skin tone looked the same and maybe was the same. But I'm just saying, and Beasley, you're it. Pianchi took off.
Oh, my God. I wish he was, he must have knew what I was going to call in, I swear.
But anyway, York, I haven't seen the film yet, so all I've read is the Wikipedia, and then I looked up something about the tribe, which is based in Benin, or what we call Benin today.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you clear.
I'll be darned. I wanted Pianca to be here, but look, Hotep, how you doing, Brother L.A.?
I'm doing fine. I'm waiting for this storm to come and go.
You know what, Brother L.A., you seem shocked. that black folks are buying land once they get some money. But
no, I'm shocked. I'm glad they're doing it.
But you act like it's a new phenomenon when we've always, when we got money, bought land.
Remember, I don't know the whole internet, but at least on Blog Talk, I've probably talked more about black townships more than anybody else on Blog Talk.
Yeah, but we've always went out to try and get something of our own. You know, we haven't been waiting on 40 acres because I sent you a text showing you that, hey, look, nobody's giving us anything. We've always had to get our stuff on our own, so ain't nobody waiting. But we've always bought land, especially in this area in North Carolina where I'm from, because the old folks used to tell us, say, look, when you get some money, always get you some dirt. That way nobody can't tell you what to do or where to go or how long to stay there. Because, see, sharecropping was dominant in this area here. And if you lived in the man's house, see, you were a slave. So I don't know why it's such a surprise to you that people are going out buying property.
Not a surprise. Now, hold on, not a surprise. What I'm trying to do is, like, I'm putting it out there where, because I know a lot more people that, for whatever reason, they want to stay in the city. They, like, for instance, when I mentioned to a friend of mine, and I sent them a video of the black couple. I said, you might want to consider Montana or the Dakotas. I mean, there are other places, plenty of other places, but she doesn't want to be in a place that doesn't have a whole lot of black people. And my thing is, you need to get past that. And if you want to have more black people, then get your own people together. You know, it can start with just two people.
It can, Brother L.A., but look, let me tell you something. I'm with the lady that you're talking about. I don't want to be out in an area by myself either. You know, you still living in a hostile environment, but I feel what she's saying. But like you're saying, hey, look, use your social capital to get somebody else to come out there with you. But look, there's plenty of land around here in North Carolina. Like you say, Georgia, not too much in South Carolina.
Yeah, now, you know what, North Carolina is a good place to go also.
Yeah, and land is cheap, living is cheap. But, you and I always get in a pissing match about, you know, waiting for the government and don't wait for the government to give you 40 acres of land. They ain't never give us nothing. So, every time you bring that up, I got to bring this up because we've always been able to go out there and try and find something on our own. And I sent you a text where the government was instrumental in black folks losing 12 million acres of farmland. I don't know if you read it or not. So
yeah, I did. Now, you wanted to mention something about Soul City.
Yeah. I sent you all of that information. I sent you how Jesse Helms used the smear campaign to make sure that Soul City never succeeded, because Floyd McKissick had lined up a lot of manufacturers to come in that area. But he used all of his clout to go in and, number one, stop the government from funding the project. Number two, when the government stopped funding the project, the manufacturers left. They didn't go through with their part. And then the News and Observer, which was a statewide newspaper, they joined in with Senator Helms, Jesse Helms, to go in, and they wrote articles left and right, just like they wrote articles in Wilmington and Tulsa to kind of turn the public against what was going on. But the thing is, Soul City would have flourished. And, you know, that goes to show you that when you go out here, you better make sure that you got your ducks in a row. Even if you're successful, they're going to go in and put resistance against you. But I sent you all of that information.
Right. Now, Sun City was that was supposed to be a government-backed program, right?
Well, what happened is when you look at the article, and look, there's a guy who wrote the book on it. There was 150 of those projects to go in and do exactly what Soul City was prepared to do. Only one of them succeeded. But what happened is all of them fail. All of them fail, and look, the guy who wrote the book, I think I sent you that, but if not, I'll send it to you again. He said that they were steadily harassed by the government because they had put it out that Floyd McKissick was mismanaging the money. And every time they pull an audit, he passed with flying colors. So, I mean, yeah, the government was doing that, but it was money appropriated out there to get such a project started anyway. So it wasn't like he went there begging. Plus, let me give you this. He was a Democrat. He switched from being a Democrat to a Republican in order to better his chances of getting on that program. And he had a hard time getting on the program. So it wasn't like, you know, it was a government program. Yeah, it was, but black folks wasn't even supposed to participate in the program.
I'm reading here. It says Soul City never came close to those projections. When development stopped 10 years later, there were just 135 jobs and 124 full-time residents. In the four decades since, Soul City has quietly faded into oblivion, becoming a modern-day ghost town. Most people have never heard, most people even in North Carolina have not even heard of it.
Well, most of the younger folks, but the older folks know about it. But look, I'm telling you now, and I don't know what part you're reading from, but I gave you the reasons.
I'm on Wikipedia
now.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know who wrote that piece, but when you talk to the white guy that wrote the book on it, and you know, most of the time we believe white folk. The thing is this, based on the political pressure, in fact, Jesse Helm said the first thing that he wanted to do was to make sure they never succeeded. When he got elected, Floyd McKissick reached out to him because he felt like since Jesse Helms was a Republican, and he was a Republican, that, you know, he'd be in favor of black folks trying to do for themselves. And Jesse Helms looked him straight in the face. He said, look, the first thing I'm going to do when I get in office is to make sure that you never succeed. And from then on out, he used all of his political influence to go in and harass that project. So now, I mean, what does that tell you? What does that tell you?
True.
And look, plus, Floyd McKissick had a thing with General Motors. He had a thing with Miller's Brewing Company and a couple other projects that looked at it and in the initial stages and say, yeah, this is something we want to do. Because I sent you another thing about the plan, and it shows that Soul City was strategically located between two interstates, a railroad, and an airport. And the thing is, the newspaper, statewide newspaper, they ran articles just about every week talking about, hey, look, putting out negative press on the thing. So, I mean, yeah, you're going to fail when you have all of that stuff going against you. And then the government cut the funding. After Jesse Helms got in there, they cut the funding.
My take on Soul City is, because I'm not big on government, particularly when it comes to housing. Um,
particularly if you're going to have, if you want to develop. I believe the best development, that's what I like about those black townships. The black townships, that was black folk with their own money buying the land in rural areas. And like I say, a lot of those towns are over 100 years old. It's probably about 700 or 800 of those towns in the United States now with absolutely no government help. Because when you get into, when just like with public schools, I don't like public schools. That's education with politics. That's why I don't like public schools. The Soul City project sounded absolutely great, but due to the fact that you had government funding involved, you got a lot of heavy politics in it, or had a lot of heavy politics in it. But the examples that I've been laying out with Freedom Georgia and, the couple up in North Dakota, these are all private individuals with no government help doing their thing. So like I said, in my opinion, once you get the government involved with educate anything, maybe not anything, but with a lot of things, your success rate decreases dramatically. That's the point I'm making.
Not necessarily so. Now, yeah, I'm like you. I funded all of my projects because I had the money. But now we have just as much right. In fact, we have more than a right than anybody else that if the government is putting out money out there for certain things, we're taxpayers too. And the thing is, those projects was out there before Floyd McKissick ever came up with the plan. And the guy that you're familiar with, his name is Harvey Gantt. He ran for state senate. I mean, the United States Senate back in the day. If Floyd McKissick hadn't gone in and looked at it and said this is an opportunity, the money was already out there for 149 other projects anyway. So he had just as much to appeal for that money as anybody else. Plus, all of the artists that they pulled to try and find a way to kill the program, those artists showed that, hey, look, this man is handling the money the right way.
Right.
The only reason he didn't succeed, two of the major reasons he didn't succeed was because Senator Jesse Helms said, look, I'm going to make sure you never succeed. And he used all of his power to do so. And the other thing is he had a newspaper, the statewide newspaper, to run negative articles against the project daily, if not weekly daily. Then Jesse Helms had the House Urban whatever what it is.
Housing Urban Development.
Yeah, and pulled several artists. And the artist said, hey, this man is handling the money the right way. So with that and look, he had already contacted GM, the Miller Brewing Company, and there was two or three other corporations said, hey, look, this is a good project. We went in on this. So it was a public private project.
Partnership.
So,
right.
Yeah, I'm like you. I mean, look, black folks never depended on the government anyway because the government has told us that we ain't getting you nothing. So now you can take that and throw it out with the bathwater because if you saw that article where I sent you about 12 million acres was stolen by the government, puts black farmers out of business. That tells you right there that, hey, look, we can't look to the government for anything, and nor do we. So the thing is this. Yeah, if that money was out there for 149 other projects, why shouldn't Floyd McKissick get it? And that was the reason why he fell into it.
You're right. If we put in the money, we should have a crack at the money. We should have a crack at it. I think private partnerships among black people, quote, small groups of black people getting together, I think that's the success formula needed to, have more. And I'm sure there's a lot more out there I just don't know about.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I see people doing what you've been suggesting all the time out here. Right. I mean, when I when I got my 40 acres, I didn't depend on the government, nor was I waiting for my 40 acres in a mute. Now, I'm advocating for the 40 acres. I'm advocating for the 160 acres like everybody else got that didn't have a hand in building this country under the Homestead Act. Damn the 40 acres. You know, but the thing is, I don't see nobody out here waiting. Now, this thing about city folk, you got some city folks that's never been on the other side of town. So it would be kind of hard to get them to see what the people have done in Freedom, Georgia, because they've never been out of the city. So with that being the case, it's not going to happen. But in these military bases around here, I found that the city people that comes and are stationed here, and they see what's happening as far as land, buying land and houses and stuff, they never go back. They never go back to the cities they came from because they found out it's a different type of life here. But, no, Soul City should have had a chance to fail on its own instead of the political and the media and the government that was influenced by political pressure to go ahead on and pull a plug on the project.
Yeah. Now, Wikipedia's got, what do they have on here? They said a good amount of the people that hold, let me read it. Hold it. Soul City. A good number of people in Soul City hadn't even graduated high school.
Yeah, but the team that was put in could be remedied. Yeah, in
that
fact,
could have been remedied, though.
Well, the deal is this. The team that was working on it with Floyd McKissick, number one, was a multiracial group. Very well educated.
Right.
And very well, and look, the plan was laid out there. Harvey Gantt had just graduated from MIT. You had a white guy that was lining up all of the corporations to come in there. But you know what? Only a fraction of America is well educated.
Right.
So with
that
being the case, that industry coming in there would have really changed the scope, the economics climate of that area. And the thing is, it was strategically located. I sent you a part that laid out the program, showed it was right on the Virginia line.
You know,
and it
really, here's something, because I'm thinking about this while we're talking about Soul City. Call me crazy, but, and this could have been done decades ago, but I got a feeling, I don't know when it's going to get, it might be out there starting already. I think a black church or black churches can put something like this together and be successful.
You read my mind. In fact, all of these black churches in North Carolina, Soul City's still there. The land is still there. The infrastructure is still there because they had already put the infrastructure in. And what you're talking about, what was it? I think it was what? Was it 5,000 acres? Or how, I got 5, to go back 5,000
acres,
look.
Man. 5,000 acres it was. And that is a lot of land.
And it's still under those black folks' control, I believe. I got to check it.
Well, the county, I think it's Warren County. Warren County,
yes.
From what I've read, is mostly a black county as far as population.
Last time I checked, I got to go back and look at the figures again. But the thing is,
let me look it up now. Warren County, North Carolina. In North Carolina, man, I can't prove it, but I think it's got to be some kind of, well, I think the time is ripe. Let me see, Warren County, North Carolina.
I'm looking it up, too. demographics.
Yeah, cause, I mean, I'm going to just use one example. We didn't talk about them. So, Creflo, man, you don't even have to be, you know what? You don't even have to be on a level near Creflo, dog. You can get a couple of storefront churches within a block or two radius of each other. Let's say a five-block radius of each other in Charlotte or Baltimore. Pick your city. We just talking about even storefront.
You don't just even need that, church. Brother Ellie. All of those counties, all of those counties surrounding Soul City, all of those churches, you don't even have to go out there for it. They could finance it. But now I just looked at the right. demographics. It's 49% black, 39% white.
Okay. So mostly a black county. Okay.
That's right. So now the thing is, you don't even have to go out there for it because I'm gonna send you the map of the towns that was in the planning around Soul City. And look,
okay.
it's between 95 and 85 interstate. So talking about people that wants to
and
get
I've
out
been
of the
up
city.
And down 95 many a time. From D.C.
many a time.
To Florida. I've driven that highway. Okay.
And look, Soul City is only about, what, an hour from Raleigh? For an hour and a half. So, look, you read my mind. If they had the mind, because they got the money.
They got you right. They got the talent.
And they got
the
talent because you got.
Go ahead.
Because look, you got black colleges. You got Shaw. You got NCCU. You got Livingston. You got Bennett. You got all of those colleges that's only about an hour and a half to 2 hours away from the whole thing.
Right.
So, you know, I mean,
you got
it's just
how
like
far
that,
is NCC, North Carolina Central? Wait, is that in Durham?
That's in Durham, but Durham is only about what a couple of hours from Soul City.
Yeah, that's not far
just
at
like
all.
Just like an hour and a half.
Right.
And Shaw's there.
Well,
Livingston College
North
is
Carolina,
there.
And then you have a lot of people. You have a lot of retiree. You got a lot of retiree money that's been floating back there for the last 30, 40 years, too.
There's no excuse for Soul City to lay there dormant.
Right.
Now, they did try to run them out. They flooded the area one time, but the people came back. That big flood that time that came through the open car dam up and flooded that area. But the people in D.C. and Baltimore turned out and helped those people to get back on their feet. But I'm just telling you now, Brother L.A., what you're talking about is doable. It's doable, but you
very
got the
doable.
Talent. And look, you got North Carolina A&T right there close by, too. Engineers, you got it all. But
yep,
when
right.
your brain's dead and you don't have an identity.
You know what? I would say, and maybe we need to do a podcast on this. I would say, you know, because at one time, people talk about Prince George's County right outside of D.C. and affluent blacks and all this. You know, people talk about Chicago with, the black businesses up that way. But I would say the number one destination for the future, North Carolina.
Well, that part anyway. Well, now look, I got news for you. You know, I always say we late to the dance. White folks are already from North Carolina, especially my area, because everybody from New Jersey, New York, and Boston, I'm out here in the park. They already buying up property around here. In fact, I get letters every day saying they want to buy my spot. And the thing is, they're planning a brand new subdivision, I guess about 3,000 feet from where all of my property is. 416 acres is set up for a subdivision. And I've already got mine mapped out. I think I told you a couple of years back that I had a surveyor go in there and lay out a subdivision.
Right.
And the thing is, I'm waiting. But, L.A., I mean, you read my mind with Soul City. And there's a whole lot of other places in other states, like Freedom, Georgia. Is another spot, but they don't have the land and the infrastructure in place like Soul City does.
Right. Well, the like I say, I'm looking at it as a trend. So I'm looking at it where, okay, like I say, I'm sure I've named everyone I know about, but I'm sure there's others out there. And like I say, you don't need a whole lot of people and just start, you know, start buying.
It's better if you do have a lot of people, but if you just have to do it and you see the opportunity, take advantage of it. I did it. You've done
right.
it.
Well, here's where I think it's going to go, Beasley. Here's where I think it's going. You got somebody that might see Freedom, Georgia, then, you know, the couple that bought, you know, two. And I think once people see it, see, a lot of people haven't seen it. A lot of, particularly church people, they talk about, you know, faith and, you know, faith and all that. But a lot of people, black, white, or whatever, if they see it, they'll believe it. Particularly if they see a black woman involved, they believe it.
Well, look, that's where you and I split the difference on that. You got black men out here, too. You got black men out here, too, now that's looking for this opportunity. And I don't think it's fair to black men to say black women, because it should be black people.
Oh, no, I'm using black women as the barometer. In other words, if she's happy, you know, to get a married couple, basically the woman is territory. She claims everything in the house, and the man's left with a chair. Now, I'm sure that's different with every household. You know, even if he has a man cave, if he doesn't watch it, she'll turn it into her place as well. So I'm just saying, as a barometer, if you see black women gravitating towards something and doing something, I'm not saying that all at once. I'm just saying, as a barometer, take note of it as a trend that you might want to follow. That's how I mean.
Oh, well, you can, but you know what? What we have to do is start teaching black males to be territorial. Now, if you can be territorial for a drug corner, you can be territorial and teach them to be territorial for some land. And that's what's going to have to happen. Because the man's
got
the money.
That's a very good analogy. That's a very good analogy, because you got these kids, God knows how many have lost their lives off of a corner that they don't even own.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So you're right.
But now look, I want to switch gears here. I got into your conversation late about black spending and black wealth and all of this stuff. And, you know what? That was spot on. But let me give you this. Have you ever heard that statistics says that white households have 118% more, $118 compared to black folks, $18,000 of wealth, or some type of outrageous figure like that? Have you heard that?
Yeah, I've heard that, and I don't really buy into that statistic, because I know some poor white folks.
Well, look, the man was right. You know what?
Okay.
He said that there's no such thing as class in America. I agree with that.
Oh, you're talking about Umar Johnson. Yeah, all right. You're right.
I don't know who it was when I was driving up to the park here. He was saying that middle-class white folk don't earn any more than poor black folk. I think that's the way he said it. I have to go back and listen to it. But look, let me give you this. When they discuss wealth, what do they consider wealth? When they say white folks got more wealth than black folks, how do they determine that they have $120,000 of wealth compared to $18,000 of wealth?
And you know what? Wealth measured in dollars
is just one wealth metric. Because, see, I measure wealth. I use, you know, water. I mean, because I'm looking at, you know, how can I put a well on here? Because I'm looking at wealth in the form of water, you know, timber, you know, how many acres of dirt can I get? So I'm measuring wealth that way. I'm not measuring just with dollars.
Well, yeah, you can. But when they throw that statistic out there, how do they determine, how do they get that statistic is what I'm asking
I don't know.
Yes, you do, because they say most of the time white families their wealth is tied up in their homes, right?
Yeah.
Their house is considered part of their wealth.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Most people use the family house with a mortgage on it as a wealth metric. You're right.
Okay. But now look, I want you to try and tear this apart, what I'm about to give you. You can't take house with a mortgage and determine that the value of that house as well. Because my definition of wealth is assets that produces revenue. That's the definition for wealth. Now, you can be rich.
Excellent metric.
But you can be rich. You can have a lot of money. You can have a lot of money, but your money ain't producing revenue.
Right.
I know a whole lot of people that's millionaires, but they just got money, which means it's not producing any income at all. So now, if your assets don't produce revenue, then you're not wealthy. And if you own a $250,000 house and you're still paying a mortgage on it, you can't determine that as wealth because, number one, you got a mortgage on it. Number two.
And that's the bank's wealth, not yours.
Exactly. And the other thing is if you sell it, then what happens is you don't have anywhere to live. So this barometer that you base part of white family's wealth on the ownership of a house, that's a false narrative,
as they would call it. Right, you're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. But see, we get tied up in this thing, yeah, man, white family's got $120,000 of wealth compared to $18,000 worth of black folks, $18,000. Well, if you look at it, that $18,000 that black folks got, if they're renting, is just as big amount as a person with a $250,000 mortgage, a boat, a truck, and a car. So with that being the case, white folks ain't wealthy. In fact, they're poorer than poor black folks. And that's what the guy was saying in your in that part where I was listening to coming over here to the park. Now let me give you another one. It takes more for black folks to live than anybody else, and I'll tell you why. We don't get the amount of money that we're supposed to get out of what we earn. You can take Mexicans, and you play that Nine Friends all the time. You can take a bunch of Mexicans, 20 of them put their money together and go to the grocery store, and they'll load their carts up and divide the food up amongst 20 families. We don't do that. One family will go in there and buy.
No, yeah, you're right. We don't do that.
Right. And then they'll go in, 15 or 20 of them will live in a house, and they split the rent or either the mortgage in that house that 15, 20 different ways. So that means they always got discretionary income, money that they can use for something else, and they do. You know, my cousin used to say, you know what, them Puerto Ricans come over here and 20 of them will live in a house. Well, after those 20 get going, each one of them, after they live in that house for a while, each one of them will have their own house, won't they?
Right.
Oh, that's what they were doing.
When I go out to Oklahoma, Taft, because Taft doesn't have any accommodations at this time,
I'll stay at the, you know, the Motel 6 in Muskogee most of the time. And you see, you know, some Latino, well, they're Mexican in that part of the country. They'll rent one room at a Motel 6, which might be $45, $50 a night, and they'll bunk up all up in there.
And look, they only got one room. That's right, and four or five of them are divvy up that room, the money for that room, and the rest of it, they can take that and put it aside for a future investment. And like you said before, see, they form wolf packs. And as a wolf pack, it doesn't cost them. They can work minimum wage, and their money will go just as far as a white person or a black person making $80,000 a year.
Right.
But see, we don't analyze that, and we don't sit down and look at things. And that's why come a Mexican can come over here and make $7.25 an hour, a bunch of them, and before you know it, they got houses and cars and everything else, because what they do is, as a wolf pack, they cut down on expenses. Everybody shares in the expenses.
Right. Right.
So with that being the case, I found what that guy was saying in I guess it's a monologue or what it was. He was showing the difference between white folks that are so-called middle class and poor blacks, and he showed where white folks ain't got no more money than black folks. Even though they make more, they spend more.
They do.
Because they got to put it in front. You know, they got to have the $250,000 house. They got to have the car, and they got to have the boat.
Right.
And the truck. And cut back on the toys like we do, because, you know, I was talking to a girl that's a friend of mine. She was talking about buying a Louis Vuitton bag for $5,000, and she's renting. You know, so with that being the case, you can see she's using bad math. Now, she's renting.
Right.
And she wants to buy a $5,000 handbag. And going
about,
and she could take the $5,000 and invest it, and keep investing the $5,000 that she's gonna spend on a bag or a pair of red bottom shoes, she told me, which is $750 a piece. And that's why come she's poor. Thought I'd bring it up.
Yeah, you got a lot of that out there. Well, I think there's some hope for that 5,000 acres.
I know it is, Brother L.A. It's just a matter of putting a presentation together. And look, there's a whole lot of people in Raleigh and Durham and Greensboro and everywhere else that could find a decent living in Soul City and surrounding areas. Even
kind of industries out that way.
Huh?
You can have all kind of industries out that way.
And look, Brother L.A., let me throw this at you. Even if you're working in Raleigh, an hour and a half drive ain't a long drive out here in the rural area. I used to go 45 miles to a job one way. I drove 90 miles round trip to make a decent living.
I don't think 2 hours is too long.
It isn't. It is,
yeah.
And especially if you're carpooling, you know.
There
I
you
mean,
go.
But like you said before, if your mind is undeveloped,
well, like I said, you don't need a whole lot of minds. That's what I like about these little groups. I mean, two people, a man and wife, you know, the 19 families. And then as more and more people see that, thanks to the internet, and then some people basically want to travel silently. Because like I said, I know a group right now, I talk to one of their members at least twice a week, you know, there's 12 of them, and they got 110 acres. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll get them on here one day to talk. So,
well,
but yeah, boy, if more people see it and hear it, then they get, I think they'll get inspired. In fact, I know they'll get inspired to do it themselves.
Well, Brother L.A., we don't have a way of going in and doing presentations like you're talking about. You know, you got to educate people.
We got the internet, we got Zoom, and then we, you know, we can have meet, greet, and eat some. I don't know if you've taken a look at it yet with the on the YouTube channel Freedom Georgia. You know, they had a take a look at some of their Georgia with they have get-togethers where they camp out together. They got their own tents. And then they also sat down and, you know, they broke bread together. So I think that'll be a way to do it.
Brother L.A., nothing beats physical appearance and meeting physically. And I'm going to say this.
Right, I agree.
A lot of people... Now, there used to be a statistic said that black folks didn't have, there were so many of a percentage of black folks didn't have the internet. And look, we're still in the 19th century. That's why some preachers are so successful, is because, look, they deal with the people where they are at physically.
Right.
And they're
right.
able to go and talk to these people. Zoom is nice. Now, I can't work Zoom. I try to work Zoom to try and get in on church meetings when, the pandemic was at its height. I don't know how to operate Zoom. And I don't do SnapCheck. And I tried to get in your room on that other thing you had. But
you talking about Clubhouse?
Clubhouse. But the trick is this, brother. You got to get out there and you got to press the flesh just like a politician does. If a politician could win...
Right.
If a politician could win on Zoom, they wouldn't be out here meeting people where they live at and where they worship at. You got to get out
there
and you got to sell that program physically.
That's true. Obama did it that way. Matter of fact, going back to Jesus did it that way. It was no technology like it is today, but you're right. Once you meet people face to face, things can, the traction builds up like instantaneously. So, yeah,
And give them a chance to interact and ask questions and show them, hey, look, these are the advantages here. Now, Zoom is good for young folk, and look, I don't even believe it works for young folk, but yeah, you can use it in certain instances, but you got to beat the bushes. You got to beat the bushes out here. And what you and I are talking about, you know what? If more people could see this and hear you and be able to ask questions with a PowerPoint presentation, hell, they'd buy up every damn thing.
And you know what I think will be better than the PowerPoint presentation? Actually take them to a location where they see people who are bought or, like the two women, what they did was – they told two friends, and they actually took them to the location where they can see it. So once people can see it, they can grasp it.
That's even better. They can see it, feel it. Pick the shoes off and get the dirt between the toes and everything else. You're right. Absolutely. But, hey, the opportunity is here, Brother L.A. And our people is waiting for something positive.
You know what? You're absolutely right. We have been waiting for something positive, and I think now is the time. That's what I'm saying. I'm looking at it as a trend. Anyway, Beasley, it's 8:08. I don't want Blog Talk to kick us off because we should have been out of here at 12:30 at the latest. All right. Talk to you later.
Yeah, you take care. I'm going to see you then.
Okay. Send it to me.